Well, let me draw us together there. And we're only halfway through the evening, but let me say a big thank you to Tim. In fact, let's give him a round of applause. Looking forward very much to hearing about the Reds. It is fun, isn't it, finding out about wines. I think you learn a little bit about yourself as well when you're tasting the wine. The other day I said to my wife, Susie, I compared myself to a Chateau Neuf du Pape. Robust, mature, and with its own particular charm. And quick as you like, she replied, I prefer a fine Burgundy. Elegant, tasteful, and not quite so full of itself. Learn a lot about yourself, you learn a lot about the state of your marriage, apparently. Well, for a few minutes, if I may, between tastings, I just want to ask a question. I want to ask the question, is Jesus just a matter of taste? Is Jesus just a matter of taste? You see, there's something in what we're doing tonight that's reminiscent, I think, of our culture's approach to Jesus. You see, Tim said it himself, didn't he? Half the fun of an evening like this is that you can taste and you can compare, and you like one wine, I like another wine, and at the end of the night we all go away and we've all got our opinions and it doesn't really matter, does it? We can all enjoy a different wine and that's just fine. And I think oftentimes people approach Jesus a little bit like that. For me, he's my idea of a good time, says one person. Another person says, he's the answer to all of my problems. And you can quickly see the comparison with wine there, can't you? Another person says, for me, he's something or someone that I like to study in depth and to learn about and get to know. Another person says, for me, he's just a seasonal indulgence that I have every once or twice a year. At the end of the day, though, the conclusion is that it's just a matter of taste. Take him or leave him, it doesn't really matter. It's fair to say, I think, actually, that's our culture's view of religion as a whole. So tonight, here we are, we're having a wine tasting, but somewhere else in London, there will be a real ale tasting, and another place will be having a cocktail tasting. And again, it doesn't really matter, does it? You can enjoy cocktails or wine or real ale, that's fine. One person wants to be a Muslim, another person wants to be a Buddhist, someone else an atheist, someone else a Christian. Take it or leave it, it's just a matter of taste. Watching a film recently, I'm sure you've seen it, you'll certainly have heard about it, the film The Life of Pi. It's a brilliantly made film, beautifully put together. And it's one of those films that, as it were, wears its worldview on its sleeve. It's pretty obvious what they think, and it embodies the kind of worldview that I'm talking about now. There's a moment in the film where the protagonist, that is Pi, has just recounted two entirely different versions of the same series of events, two very different versions of the same series of events. And then he says to the person he's talking to, which story did you prefer? Which version of reality did you prefer? And the person gives him his opinion. And then he says these words, well, so it is with God. So it is with God. You can choose your own way. Choose your own story. Make up your own version of God. And God's happy with that. That's what he wants. Approach him however you want. It's a different retelling of the story you might have heard of the mountain. Do you know the mountain with the same God at the top and lots of different paths all wending their way? You can choose whichever path you want and you will find your way to God in the end. It's sort of postmodernism meets religion. At the end of the day, it's all just a matter of taste. But I want to ask, what would Jesus make of that? If he was standing here amongst us this evening, that approach to him, that he's just a matter of taste, take him or leave him. We could think what he might say philosophically speaking. I suspect he might refer to the kind of what one philosopher has referred to as the self-referential incoherence of that view. What do I mean by that? Well, the fact that it doesn't really stand up to its own standards. The idea that an absolute truth claim can say that all other truth claims are equally valid, even when those truth claims deny the truth of the other truth claims. Now, you think about it for a minute, you can begin to see how that statement might just unravel pretty quickly under some analysis. That is this view of a religion. But rather than approach the question philosophically, what I want us to do for a few minutes is just to examine the words of Jesus himself and to see what the implications are for this question. And I want to do that just by looking at some words from Mark's Gospel. You've all got copies of Mark on your table, and I'd love you to pick it up now and get it in your hands, mainly because I want you to see for yourself what we're talking about rather than relying on me. Turn to page 23 of Mark's Gospel. And I'm just going to read a few verses from chapter 8. In these verses, for what it's worth, we get a little opportunity to eavesdrop on a conversation that takes place between Jesus and some of his closest disciples. I'm going to read from verse 27 on page 23 down to verse 32. And Jesus went on with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And they told him, "John the Baptist, and others say Elijah, and others one of the prophets." And he asked them, "But who do you say that I am?" Peter answered him, "You are the Christ." And he strictly charged them to tell no one about him. Going on, verse 31, and he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed, and after 3 days rise again. And he said this plainly. Like I say, we're eavesdropping on a conversation between Jesus and his disciples. And Jesus raises the question with them. What is the average person on the street, the man on the street, the woman on the street, what are they saying about me from what you can tell? And the answer comes back. Well, some John the Baptist, others say Elijah, and some say one of the prophets. And you can sort of sense the sort of postmodern overtones to it. You could transfer that easily to 21st century London, couldn't you? Some say a good teacher, others say a prophet of substance, others say a con man, some say a politician par excellence. It's just a matter of taste. Everyone has their own opinion. But Jesus wants to focus in, and so he asks the disciples particularly, "Who do you say that I am?" And Peter chirps up with an answer. "You are the Christ," he says. Now, in the grand scheme of Mark's Gospel, this is a pretty significant moment. It's kind of a hinge point, if you like. Mark's Gospel is 16 chapters long. We're in chapter 8, and this is kind of a central moment. Because up until this point, if you were to read through Mark's Gospel, and I hope you might do that, I hope you might take this away and read through it. If you were to do that, you would see that the first 8 chapters of the book are all about Jesus demonstrating who he is. So if you were to read through, you'd see all sorts of different incidents. You'd see him healing someone who is on their deathbed, moments from death. With a word, he heals them. Someone else has been paralyzed all of their life, withered limbs. They're lying there. And again, just with a word, Jesus raises them up and they walk. There's even a young girl who dies, who Jesus brings back to life. On another day, he's confronted by a huge storm, a tempest, swirling around him. And again, just with a word, he turns it to a millpond. It's pretty compelling stuff. And it is eyewitness evidence in Mark's Gospel. But in this moment in Mark's Gospel, Peter shows that he's the first person to, as it were, put two and two together. Peter's been with him all the way along. He's seen so much of this stuff, and he realizes what it says about Jesus, that he is the Christ. And when he says those words, "You are the Christ," they land, if you like, with a thud on the table. Because the word Christ, to us it sounds a bit like a surname, doesn't it? Jesus Christ, that was presumably his surname. But to the original reader, this comes with a whole weight of Old Testament history. 1,500 years of scripture have been written, all pointing towards this figure who was and would be the Christ, which is the Greek word for the Hebrew Messiah and the English King. It means King. You are the King. But not just any King. When the Bible speaks of this King, it speaks of someone who is the King of the universe, the King of the whole created order, the whole cosmos, the one who made everything in the beginning and who has, therefore, the right to our allegiance and to our obedience, to our love, even, you might say. This title Christ, which Jesus is very happy to accept for himself, is a huge authority claim. That's what's going on here. Jesus is accepting a huge authority claim for himself. And those words, "You are the Christ," they would have rung out all around the world, beyond Israel, to all of the nations. And indeed, they ring down the generations, down the decades, the centuries, the millennia, to us here today. That was the expectation, that this Christ, when he came, would prove himself to be the ruler of the whole cosmos for all of time. It's a huge claim that is being made for Jesus and that he's accepting for himself. And you can see, can't you, that if that's true, and I appreciate here tonight you will have lots of questions about that claim, and those will be great questions to ask of each other and to discuss over the next glass of wine that we enjoy. That was nothing Freudian about that. I'm enjoying myself. Those would be good questions to talk about over the next glass of wine. But if it's true that Jesus is the Christ, then you can see, can't you, that that cuts against this take him or leave him approach. The idea that he might just be a matter of taste. If he is who they say he is, then that's a pretty significant thing. Now, I have this daydream, and I concede it is a slightly odd daydream. I floated it with a couple of other people yesterday and discovered that it is just me who has this daydream. When I'm walking down the road, I'll pass someone who, for whatever reason, personally speaking, I find them particularly unattractive. And then for whatever reason, my mind goes into this scenario where I wake up one morning and I'm lying next to them, married to them, sort of caught in this scenario that I don't know how I got there. Yeah, I concede it is pretty odd. The beauty of this scenario, this daydream, is that when you snap out of it, you're very happy to be married to the person you are married to. And I am that, very happily married to my wife. I wonder if you feel a little bit like that on the back of the claim that's just been made, that you've kind of stumbled into the spiritual equivalent of my daydream. Jesus is the Christ, claiming to be the king of the whole universe, and you're kind of caught up in that. All of a sudden, he's claiming to have authority over you. You've woken up next to him, as it were, and there's this despot ruling over the whole universe, and you apparently don't have any choice as to whether or not you should be submitting to him. Whether that's a good state of affairs or a bad state of affairs depends upon the kind of king that Jesus is. And Jesus himself is very keen to give definition to the kind of king that he is. It's exactly what he does as he goes on in verse 31. Have a look down. "And he began to teach them that the Son of Man," this is again a title that Jesus takes for himself that speaks of his authority. "He began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and after 3 days, rise again." What kind of king is Jesus? He's a king who must die. Now, if I was to walk in here this evening to take up the microphone and say to you, "Do you know the best thing I can do for the world is to die?" You would think that was slightly odd, I suspect. You might agree. And if that's the case, let's have a glass of wine later and settle our differences. But it would be an odd thing for me to say. But that is exactly what Jesus is saying here. In fact, he doesn't just say it once in Mark's gospel. He says it 3 times just in the next 2 chapters alone. "I must die, I must die, I must die." And by the end of Mark's gospel, that's exactly what he's done. He's died as he said he would. But where my death would be purposeless and in vain, in Jesus' case, the opposite is true. His death was not a purposeless one. See, Jesus, the king of the universe, comes down to earth in the form of a man, and he comes to die for his people. You see, the truth of the matter is that by nature, not one of us, not you, not me, can say that we are on good terms with Jesus by nature. We can't look him in the eye, as it were, and say we deserve to be in his kingdom, citizens in his kingdom. None of us has treated him with the respect that he deserved, given him the love or the honor or the allegiance that he deserves. We don't meet his standards. I don't even meet my own standards, let alone his standards. And the consequence of that is that by rights we should be cut off, cast out of his kingdom. We should die and die forever. But Jesus is the kind of king who wants to come and to die for his people. That's what he's saying here and says time and again. And that is exactly what he does. He dies for the sake of his people. If you've ever wondered what was going on the cross 2,000 years ago, well, now you know. Jesus was dying in the place of anyone who puts their trust in him. He hung on a cross so that, as it were, we don't have to. He was cut off from God so that we needn't be. He died in our place for our sins if we put our trust in him. And when you understand that act in those terms, you begin to see that that is a morally beautiful thing for him to have done. It is a morally excellent thing for him to have done. Jesus Christ himself said in a different part of the Bible, he said, "Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." And I think it's pretty hard to quibble with that statement. It is the greatest act of love anyone could ever have, to give up their life for the sake of others. And that's the kind of king Jesus was. It's the kind of king he is. A king who comes in order to die for his people out of love for them. You see, every other system, religious, atheistic, whatever it is, at the end of the day, when you boil it down, it asks something of you. Indeed, more often than not, it demands something of you, a certain level of behavior, a certain conformity to a subculture, whatever it might be. Christianity is the polar opposite. Jesus Christ comes and he doesn't demand anything of us. Instead, he gives for us. And he gives his own life for us. The most spectacular act of love on behalf of his people. He takes all of that authority that was his by rights, and rather than lording it over us, instead, he gives it up and sacrifices himself for the sake of his people. You see, these verses show us what the reality is as far as Jesus is concerned, that he's the Christ, he's the king, the one who rules over all things. But then they show us as well that that is actually very good news. Every other king wants to come and take from us. Jesus is the one who comes and gives on our behalf. So is Jesus just a matter of taste? Well, by his own terms, he would say no. He's not just a matter of taste, he's the Christ. But he's the Christ who comes and who dies for his people. Now, I'm aware that what I've said has probably raised more questions than it's answered. And I'm glad of that if it has. I hope that there are lots of questions flying around in your minds now. And the rest of the evening is a very good opportunity to be talking about those things. But if you wanted to push things a little bit harder, to look into things a bit deeper, there are a few ways you could do that. You've got Mark's Gospel in your hand, and we would love you to take that away. That's our gift to you, no extra cost or anything like that. And you could read that yourself. You could do it in about an hour if you wanted to, or over a few mornings. Better than that, perhaps, you could ask the person who's brought you this evening if they wouldn't mind meeting up over a few lunch times to read it together and to answer questions and ask them and that kind of thing. That might be a good way forwards. Also, you might want to take up the opportunity that the Christianity Explored course we run represents. You've got flyers on your table with One Life written on them. They will tell you more about those courses. It runs over 7 weeks. The start dates are on there, and that runs over 7 Monday evenings. It's very relaxed, very laid back, very informal, just for a couple of hours with a meal, a short talk from Mark's Gospel, a chance to study it for yourselves, and then a chance to ask any question you want. And any question is allowed. No singing, no praying, no nothing like that. Just a relaxed chance to look into things a bit deeper. And again, if you wanted to do that, you'd be very welcome. Details for how to sign up are on the flyers there. Similarly, if you'd like us to get in touch and let you know about more about what's going on at St. Helens, you've got on your tasting sheet there details of how to do that. But that is it for me for the moment. We're going to take a 5-minute break. If you want to use the facilities, feel free. And then Tim will get back up and we'll get on with more wine tasting. Thanks for listening.